content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 2nd, 2017 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's Middle East reset. What happened? Kicking off his first foreign trip with a whirlwind tour of the Middle East, President Trump this week adopted a strikingly softer tone on Islam, urged Arab leaders to step up their efforts to stamp out extremism, and pledged to launch a new peace process in Israel. The president was given an elaborate red carpet reception in Riyadh, where he announced a $110 billion arms deal with Saudi King Salman and helped launch a new global center to combat extremist ideology. Addressing the premiers of about 50 Muslim nations, Trump described Islam as one of the world's great faiths, saying the battle against extremism wasn't between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations, but between good and evil. He called on the leaders to drive radicals out of their societies, urged them to work together to isolate Iran, and, in a thinly veiled repudiation of President Obama's 2009 Cairo speech on human rights, reassured them he wouldn't lecture them about how to live. His approach, he said, would be based on principled realism. Trump then traveled from Saudi Arabia to Israel on what was believed to be the first ever direct flight between the two nations. The president, who also became the first sitting U.S. leader to visit Jerusalem's Western Wall, told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that the common cause Israel shared with its Arab neighbors over the threat posed by extremism in Iran could serve as a foundation for better relations. After meeting Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank city of Bethlehem, Trump said both sides were ready to reach for peace. The president's trip continued on to Europe, where he met Pope Francis at the Vatican. Last year, Trump and the pontiff exchanged harsh words when Francis said a person who wants to build walls rather than bridges is not Christian, a criticism Trump called disgraceful. In person, the two leaders spoke privately for 30 minutes, and in a pointed gesture, the Pope gave Trump his encyclical on climate change. The president then flew to Brussels for meetings with EU and NATO leaders and was scheduled to end the 9-day trip in Sicily at the annual G7 summit. What the editorials said. Given his long history of comments such as "Islam hates us," President Trump's more responsible tone in Saudi Arabia was long overdue, said the New York Times. But his new Middle East strategy, forging an alliance with Saudi Arabia and other Sunni states against Shiite-led Iran, is a huge mistake. The Saudis' human rights record is no better than Iran's, and they're responsible for spreading Wahhabism, the fundamentalist Sunni orthodoxy that gave rise to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other terrorist groups. The Iranians, on the other hand, had just re-elected the moderate President Hassan Rouhani, reaffirming their interest in engagement with the West. Is this really the time to be giving up on them? Don't pay too much attention to that sham presidential vote in Iran, said the Wall Street Journal. Rouhani has presided over continuing domestic repression and regional aggression, and the Revolutionary Guards continue to assist President Assad's troops in Syria. Shiite militias in Iraq, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. In other words, President Obama's nuclear deal was as foolish as its critics warned. Granted, the Saudis are imperfect allies, but they're the linchpins of the U.S.-led order in the Middle East. Let's hope this reset is permanent, what the columnist said. Give Trump credit for picking sides, said Timothy Stanley in CNN.com. No, the choice isn't ideal. Saudi Arabia is a fossilized monarchy that won't even let women drive. But compared with Iran, whose fanatical religious leaders want to hurt the West, the Saudis aren't the bad guys. But in sucking up to the Saudis, said Peter Beinart in TheAtlantic.com, Trump only proved he's a phony and a coward. The tough guy who insisted for 2 years on saying radical Islam suddenly became politically correct when he landed on Arab soil and bowed meekly when the Saudi royals flattered him with honors and praise. This is typical. Trump said wildly offensive things about Mexico and China, only to crumple when he met their leaders in person. As for Trump's pledge to forge an Israel-Palestine peace deal, good luck to him, said Greg Carlstrom in Politico.com. Netanyahu's right-wing government is loath to make any concessions to Palestinians, who are themselves split between Fatah and Hamas. And while leadership changes may be on the horizon, Abbas is 82 and unhealthy. Netanyahu is immersed in a corruption scandal. Their most likely replacements are even less likely to make a deal. Besides, Trump is already politically wounded at home and may not have much political capital to spend on the peace process. Still, you never know, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Trump's strategy is wildly divergent from his predecessors. He hopes to thaw relations between the Arab world and Israel before taking on the issue of Palestinian statehood. There's no guarantee this unorthodox approach will work, but it is at least a new strategy. After so many failed attempts at peace, it's time to abandon our burdensome dog-eared diplomatic playbook and give Trump a chance. The controversy of the week, Trump. Did he obstruct justice? We now have a smoking gun that President Trump has committed obstruction of justice, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. In fact, we have multiple smoking guns. There can no longer be any doubt that the president fired then-FBI Director James Comey in order to quash the Bureau's investigation of Trump's Russia's ties. In an account the White House doesn't dispute, the New York Times reported last week that the day after canning Comey, Trump bragged to Russia's foreign minister, "I just fired the head of the FBI. I faced great pressure because of Russia. That's taken off." Earlier, Trump admitted in an NBC interview he fired Comey over this Russia thing. On top of that, the Washington Post reported, Trump asked his own appointees as director of national intelligence and the head of national security agency to issue statements clearing him and his campaign of collusion with Russia, a request both refused. What more evidence could possibly be needed that Trump has committed a high crime and misdemeanor for which the constitutional remedy is impeachment? Trump keeps getting away with violating all norms of politics and decency, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com. But we now may have finally reached a tipping point. Trump's admissions that he repeatedly interfered with an investigation into his own campaign feel like the beginning of the end. Trump may be a terrible president, said David Harsanyi in the New York Post. But the remedy for bad presidents is to vote them out of office. Impeachment is for actual high crimes against the nation. And for all the media's hysteria, there has been no evidence offered so far to prove collusion between Trump and Russia in the 2016 election. Last week, Reuters breathlessly reported that Trump campaign had 18 undisclosed contacts with Russians, but then added that investigators have found no evidence of wrongdoing so far. Trump may not know what he's doing, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com, but he's done nothing yet that rises to the level of an impeachable offense. It's not unconstitutional to be a fool. When Special Counsel Robert Mueller investigates all those contacts with a hostile foreign power, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, collusion is a real possibility. So are illegal financial entanglements between Trump, his associates, and the Russians. Last week, it was reported that investigators are targeting Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as a person of interest. But as with Richard Nixon's Watergate, Trump's cover-up may be his undoing. It is now almost undeniable that Trump abused presidential power to get Comey off his back. Trump and several of his closest allies are now in grave legal and political danger. Maybe so, said David Korn in MotherJones.com, but there will be no impeachment while Republicans control Congress. GOP lawmakers know their legislative priorities would be torpedoed if they took on Trump. They must also consider what a vengeful ex-President Trump and his millions of supporters might do if he were removed from office. For Republicans to break ranks with Trump would risk a nuclear civil war that could blow their party to smithereens. That calculation could change, however, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. Privately, many GOP lawmakers admit they dislike Trump and are sick of his relentless self-sabotage. If evidence continues to mount that Trump committed an impeachable offense, Republicans may decide they're better off being the patriots who uncovered it rather than the hacks who suppressed it. It was a good week for MSNBC. After the left-leaning news channel topped both CNN and Fox News in overall weekly ratings among 25 to 54-year-old viewers for the first time in its 21-year history, thanks to the intensity of liberal interest in President Trump, Fox finished in third place for the first time since 2000. It was a good week for flying under the radar after King Willem Alexander of the Netherlands revealed that he'd been secretly working as a part-time co-pilot for KLM Airlines over the past two decades. He said he likes having a hobby for which I need to concentrate fully. And it was a good week for speaking truth to power after First Lady Melania Trump swatted away the president's hand as he tried to hold hers when the couple arrived in Tel Aviv. In Rome the next day, Melania again pulled away her hand away when her husband reached for it. But it was a bad week for the greatest show on earth. After Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus staged its final performance, bowing to pressure from animal rights groups and ending its 146-year run. I'll have to look for a job, said trapeze artist Peter Gold. It was a bad week for T-Rex rights after a South Carolina woman in an orange dinosaur suit was charged with disorderly conduct for allegedly scaring carriage horses on the street, causing a driver to fall off his carriage. And finally, it was a bad week for last-minute shopping after a Florida woman buying a birthday card at 10 p.m. found herself trapped inside a locked CVS when employees closed the store without noticing her still in an aisle. I started screaming. Is anyone here? Said Lillian Rimmel, who was rescued after she dialed 911. Thank you. We're on the briefing page, the title of our article today, The Free Speech Wars. America's universities are being roiled by violent protest over offensive speech that students say should be silenced. What are the protests about? They center on whether students should be able to prevent guest speakers whom they find offensive from appearing on campus. In January, police at the University of California, Berkeley, had to cancel a talk by right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos after an Antifa, that's anti-fascists, activist stormed police barricades, causing $100,000 worth of damage. 2 months later, Berkeley said it couldn't guarantee the safety of an event involving conservative commentator Ann Coulter, leading to its cancellation. At a talk at Middlebury, the liberal arts college in Vermont, the controversial social scientist Charles Murray was shouted down by students and chased out of town. Conservatives and many liberals have decried these and other protests as a dangerous impingement on free speech. But some left-wing students and academics believe bigoted speech is a form of oppression and thus shouldn't be tolerated. We won't put up with the violent rhetoric of Milo Trump or the fascist alt-right, said one protester at Berkeley. We are willing to resist by any means necessary. How long has this been going on? Over the past decade, many universities have accepted the argument that they have a responsibility to protect students from material that makes them uncomfortable. Professors provide trigger warnings before discussing books or historical events that deal with racism or rape to avoid re-traumatizing people who have been affected by those issues. Activists are also demanding to be shielded from microaggressions, words or phrases that convey subtle racism, sexism, or some other put-down of groups that have suffered discrimination. If a white American asks an Asian American, "Where do you come from?" that is a microaggression. Students have also vehemently objected to a number of commencement speakers. Among them, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice at International Monetary Fund Chief Christine Lagarde on political grounds, resulting in their being disinvited. Many students now want their entire campus to be a safe space, free of any speech that might be considered racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, or offensive in any way. What is their justification? Social justice activists argue that certain kinds of speech reinforce hierarchies of power structures that oppress vulnerable groups. They say that when a white conservative male like Yiannopoulos mocks Muslims or transgender people, it isn't just an opinion. It is an assault by a member of a privileged class on a less powerful group. This theory essentially holds that words aren't just words. They are also tools of oppression. The right of free speech, says New York University professor Ulrich Baer, should not mean that someone's humanity or their right to participate in political speech as political agents can be freely attacked, demeaned, or questioned. Many left-wing academics and students subscribe to the theory of intersectionality, in which nearly all human interactions have an implicit power and status dynamic. A white male has an advantage over a white female, who has an advantage over a black female, who has an advantage over a black gay female, who has an advantage over a black trans female. In this worldview, people with privileged social rank can use speech to render other people invisible. What is the counterargument? Conservatives and traditional liberals argue that our Constitution enshrines free speech as one of our most basic rights, and that it especially protects words and ideas deemed offensive or forbidden. They say that no one should be given a heckler's veto over views he or she doesn't like, and that the best response to bad speech is more good speech. If somebody has a bad or offensive idea, prove it wrong, said former President Barack Obama at a graduation speech last year. Engage it, debate it, stand up for what you believe in. Free speech advocates believe that people learn best when their beliefs are challenged and have to be defended. They also argue that safe spaces provide inadequate preparation for the real world. Conservatives in particular mock today's students as Generation Snowflake, so emotionally fragile they melt whenever they're offended, which is often. Why is all this happening now? There are several factors. Some social scientists believe that baby boomer parents who grew up in the turbulent high crime era of the 1960s and 70s protected and coddled their children, making them more susceptible to offense. Political polarization has increased the rancor between people of different views so that they see their opponents not as merely wrong, but as evil. Social media has made it easier for people to share offensive material and for activists to foment and organize opposition to it. And with the rising cost of tuition, universities are increasingly treating their students like customers and thus are more willing to yield to protests. All of this has left academics deeply worried about the future of free speech. If we can't get this right at our elite universities, said Nicholas Christakis, a Yale professor who was caught up in a fiery debate over Halloween costumes in 2015, we're doomed. And it's time to read a few columns. We'll start with one from Sweden, How Assange Evaded Justice. Justice was not served in the case of Julian Assange, said Oisin Cantwell. 7 years ago, two women accused the WikiLeaks founder of sexually assaulting them when he visited Stockholm to give a lecture. When a court in the UK, his home at the time, ordered the Australian to be deported to Sweden in 2012, he took refuge at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been ever since. Assange refused to leave the building, saying that extradition to Sweden was a ruse to extradite him forward to the U.S., where he claims he's wanted for leaking classified State Department documents. Last week, Sweden's chief prosecutor, Marianne Nye, dropped her country's rape investigation, saying Assange's evasions had made it impossible for them to pursue their probe. It's the right call, but it's still a failure of justice. Assange is now crowing that he's been exonerated, but of course he has not. Instead, two women who have been exposed to considerable amounts of bile and hatred over the past 6 years will not have their cases tested in open court. Nor is Assange, 45, free. If he steps out of the embassy, British police will likely arrest him for jumping bail, and nobody knows if there's a U.S. warrant. There are no winners in this sad story. From Poland, rejecting European values. Are we headed for a poll exit? Asked Marcin Stasinski. Poland's ruling right-wing Law and Justice Party, the PIS, has already started to distance the country from the democratic and liberal European Union by trampling on the Constitution, the rule of law, the division of powers, and civil liberties. Now it's adding the embrace of nationalism and racism to its anti-European tilt and setting up a showdown with the EU. The issue is simple. At the height of the migrant crisis in 2015, the EU agreed to spread some 160,000 asylum seekers among the bloc's member states, a decision Poland voted against. Now the EU has warned Poland that it will face legal sanctions if it does not participate. But the PIS adamantly refuses, saying that it is impossible for our country of 38 million to resettle the 6,200 people that make up our share of the refugee burden. Clearly, that is a lie. The Catholic Church in Poland has offered a plan for each parish to take in one refugee family. And with more than 10,000 Polish parishes, we could take in many thousands of people. Yet our ostentatiously Catholic government, the same government that welcomed Pope Francis to Poland last year with open arms, won't even consider it. How long will the EU continue to support a country that doesn't care about European values? And this from Canada, paying for the recklessness of others. Canadian taxpayers are on the hook for the poor choices of some of our neighbors, said the Globe and Mail. Earlier this month, thousands of families were evacuated from their Quebec homes because of severe flooding brought on by heavy rainfall. Nearly all the damage occurred in known floodplains, meaning the people who bought houses there should have realized they were at risk. Yet the federal government is going to compensate them. When Canadians are facing natural disasters, we pull together, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said. But was it a natural disaster? Flooding in a flood zone is entirely predictable, even if uncommon. Of course, the government allowed these people to build in these areas, so we can't just abandon them, any more than we can deny health care to smokers and heavy drinkers. But given that climate change is increasing the likelihood of ever more severe flooding, we must do something to mitigate the cost to those of us on the higher ground. The best answer may be some form of public-private insurance. Homeowners will have to be officially informed if they live in an at-risk area, and then required to purchase flood coverage, perhaps with a subsidy. The waters are going to keep rising. We have to be prepared. And time for the last word, titled this week, Straight Talk About Teeth. Few things better illustrate the gap between rich and poor in America than dental care, says journalists Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. Millions of Americans work full-time and still can't afford basic insurance. 2 hours before sunrise, Dee Mattello joined the line outside the Wicomico Civic Center in Salisbury, Maryland, where hundreds of people in hoodies, heavy coats, and wool blankets braced against the wind. Inside, reclining dental chairs were arrayed in rows across the arena's vast floor. Days later, the venue would host Disney on Ice. On this Friday morning, dentists arriving from five states were getting ready to fix the teeth of the first 1,000 people in line. Mattello was number 503. The small business owner who supports President Donald Trump had a cracked molar, no dental insurance, and a nagging soreness that had forced her to chew on the right side of her mouth for years. Although her toothache wasn't why she voted for Trump, it was a constant reminder of one reason she did. The feeling that she had been abandoned, left struggling to meet basic needs in a country full of fantastically rich people. As the distance between rich and poor grows in the United States, few consequences are so overlooked as the humiliating divide in dental care. High-end cosmetic dentistry is soaring, and better-off Americans spend over $1 billion each year just to make their teeth a few shades whiter. Millions of others rely on charity clinics and hospital ERs to treat painful and neglected teeth. Unable to afford expensive root canals and crowns, many simply have them pulled. Nearly one in five Americans older than 65 do not have a single real tooth left. Over 2 days at the Civic Center, volunteer dentists would pull 795 teeth. A remarkable number of patients held steady jobs, forklift operator, librarian, postal worker, but said they had no dental insurance and not enough cash to pay for a dentist. Metello had both problems, adding to her frustration about being cut off from a world that many wealthier Americans take for granted. The country is way too divided between well-off people and people struggling for everything, even to see the dentist, she said. And the worst part is, I don't see a bridge to cross over to be one of those rich people. Metello voted for Barack Obama in 2008, thinking he offered the best option for working people. But she sat out the 2012 election. Last year, she rallied behind Trump after listening to him talk about the forgotten men and women of our country, people who work hard but don't have a voice. I'm running to be their voice, Trump said. What Metello heard was a promise to restore pride to the working poor. A big part of that promise was Trump's assurance that he would build a beautiful health care system that would cost less and do more. But nearly 4 months into Trump's presidency, Metello sees Trump backing a Republican health care plan that appears to leave low-income people and the elderly worse off. I am hearing about a number of people who will lose their coverage under the new plan, Metello said. Is Trump the wolf in grandma's clothes? My husband and I are now saying to each other, did we really vote for him? Straight white teeth are associated with social success. Just about everyone on TV or with a big job has them. People drop $2,000 per tooth on porcelain veneers to hide the smallest imperfections. If I see someone with perfect teeth, I think, oh man, they're out of my league, Metello said. Us poor people status each other. We're like, ah, dude, you don't have any teeth. Or if you see someone with jagged yellow stubs, you think, oh man, you have lived here your whole life, haven't you? Here is Maryland's Eastern Shore, the poorest part of one of the country's richest states. It's a region famous for chicken farms. Purdue's headquarters is here in Salisbury, a town of 30,000. Metello lives 20 miles north in Laurel, Delaware, near fields that sprout corn, watermelon, and soybeans. In these rural areas, even the water can work against people. Many homes, including Metello's, rely on well water. Unlike water from public systems, well water is not fluoridated. Nationwide, 25% of Americans are not connected to a fluoridated water system and therefore are missing out on what the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention called one of the 10 great health advances of the 20th century. In these places, we see people with a different level of dental problems, said Patricia Higgins, one of the dentists volunteering at the Salisbury Clinic. George Axe, director of the dental department at Chesapeake Healthcare, a clinic near Salisbury, said people with oral pain and infections are inundating hospitals. Last year, more than 2 million emergency room visits were attributed to neglected teeth. What I am seeing is absolutely horrifying, said Axe, who recently testified about the problem before the Maryland legislature. Although those hospital visits cost an estimated $1.6 billion a year, the ER is generally not equipped to fix dental problems, Axe told lawmakers. So ER doctors just medicate people with a perpetual cycle of antibiotics and opioids. The cycle is feeding a nationwide epidemic of opioid addiction. Meanwhile, Higgins said, Americans' increasing reliance on all kinds of drugs is ruining their teeth. Many drugs cause dry mouth, which leads to more cavities. When she started her practice 35 years ago, she said, people took fewer prescription drugs. Now patients hand her printouts with long lists of them. Metello's problem wasn't complicated. A molar shattered a year ago. The 46-year-old mother of three had not seen a dentist in 9 years. When parts of her tooth broke off, she knew fixing it could cost hundreds of dollars, and other bills were always more urgent. Then she heard on TV that the nonprofit Mission of Mercy was coming to the Eastern Shore to host one of its free dental clinics that had drawn overnight crowds in Nebraska, North Carolina, and other parts of the country. So she decided to take Friday off. Matello and her husband own a small vending machine business called Delicious, spending their days restocking 69 machines installed in factories, schools, and office buildings. They offer granola bars and other helpful snacks, but Snickers sells best. Life was easier before the recession hit in 2007. Her husband managed a furniture warehouse making more than $70,000 a year, and she sold fishing boats, adding to their income. But then people stopped buying big-ticket sofas and boats, and they both lost their jobs. Today they bring in about $47,000 a year. Matello says she doesn't know if the country's rich-poor divide is worse now, but it sure feels more in your face. And teeth, she said, are the telltale, visible sign of wealth. The Washington, D.C. region was one of the greatest concentrations of dentists in the world, with many offering high-end services in offices that resemble spas. More than 50 million Americans, by contrast, live in areas officially designated by the federal government as dental health professional shortage areas. A great many of them are working poor. It's completely skewed. You have the fewest dentists where the need is greatest, Ack said. He recently sent a local patient with impacted wisdom teeth 120 miles to a dental specialist who would accept Medicaid. Now dentists often start out with significant debt, and they gravitate toward wealthy areas where they have a better shot at making money. The typical graduate from a four-year post-collegiate dental school owes $260,000, more than the average medical student. Then there's the matter of payment. Teeth generally are treated separately from the rest of the body, a tradition that dates to dentistry's origins as a specialty of barbers who performed oral surgery and pulled teeth. Today, many public health officials view that division as a mistake. Poor oral health can lead to heart disease and other serious medical problems, and tooth loss can lead to depression and difficulty eating and speaking. The separation extends to insurance. Even Medicare, the federal health care program that covers 55 million seniors and disabled people, does not cover dental problems. For that, people must buy dental insurance, which typically limits annual benefits to about $1,500 per person, an amount that has barely budged in decades. The price of employer-provided plans varies greatly and can cost a family $500 a year or more, industry experts said. For those whose jobs don't offer dental benefits, it can be even more expensive. So tens of millions go without it. More than a third of American adults have no dental coverage, according to the ADA's Health Policy Institute. Adults who are poor enough and live in certain states can get coverage through Medicaid, but only about 38% of dentists accept Medicaid, about half the rate of physicians, in part because of low reimbursement rates. On average, Medicaid covers about 37% of the bill, according to a recent ADA analysis. In a handful of states, Medicaid offers no dental coverage for adults. Delaware, where Matello lives, is one of them, which is why, on a damp Friday morning, she found herself lining up with hundreds of other people with aching teeth. At 9:44 a.m., 5 hours after arriving, Matello finally made it inside the Civic Center and began to warm up. "What do you need done?" she asked an older veteran in a wheelchair. "Need 9 teeth pulled," he said. "My wife works at Rite Aid, and we don't have any insurance." A little afternoon, Matello's number was called. A volunteer took her temperature. She was running a slight fever, but not high enough to stop treatment. 2 more hours, she was waved over to an X-ray machine under a basketball hoop, finally. Just as Metello expected to be called for her turn in the dentist chair, a volunteer announced in a loud voice, "Those up to number 500 will be seen today. The rest will have to come back tomorrow." Metello's eyes filled with tears. She had been waiting 10 hours. A volunteer gave her a wristband that would put her at the head of the line the next day. So she drove home in her 18-year-old Jeep, ate dinner chewing only on the right side yet again, and set her alarm. By 7 a.m. the next day, she was finally in one of the reclining chairs, with a dentist pointing a bright light into her mouth. Robert Testani, a volunteer dentist from Catonsville, Maryland, examined Metello and checked her x-ray before easing a syringe of Novocaine into her mouth. He prepared to pull her broken molar. "Don't worry, this is routine," he said. He paused. "Except for the setting. Over 2 days, 116 dentists treated 1,165 patients, providing $1 million worth of fillings and other care." Metello was grateful. She was told her panoramic x-ray and extraction would have cost $600 to $800 in a regular office. She looked at some of the others who had come here. Despite working for a living, cutting down trees, building homes, minding town library, running small businesses. "We are not staying home, not sleeping, and living off the government," she said. She wondered why there wasn't a better system for people like her. She tried not to look at the 51-year-old truck driver lying next to her who'd had 3 teeth pulled, his mouth stuffed with bloody gauze. "I am trying to think that this is not demeaning," she said as she cleared the chair for the next person in line. "But it is. It's like a third world country." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries this week. Roger Ailes, 1940 to 2017, the TV news guru who transformed American politics. During his second run for president in 1967, Richard Nixon complained to a young producer on a daytime talk show that he loathed TV, calling the medium a gimmick. "Television is not a gimmick," the producer, Roger Ailes, shot back. "And if you think that, you'll lose again." Impressed, Nixon hired Ailes to run his TV strategy. And over the next 5 decades, Ailes demonstrated the power of the small screen. His media savvy helped 3 GOP candidates, Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush, win the Oval Office. He then joined forces with media magnate Rupert Murdoch to set up Fox News, an unabashedly conservative counterweight to what Ailes called the Clinton News Network. With its liberal bashing and heated rhetoric, Fox News became the nation's most popular, influential, and divisive cable news channel. Until his abrupt ouster last year over sexual harassment allegations, Ailes wielded more power than most elected officials. "Television is the most powerful force in the world," he said. "Politics is nothing compared with this." Born in Warren, Ohio, Ailes was the son of a physically abusive father, said the Washington Post. His dad once urged him to jump from a bunk bed into his arms, only to step back at the last second. "Don't ever trust anybody," he told the boy. After graduating from Ohio University, Ailes took a job with the Mike Douglas Show, a Cleveland-based TV talk show. He moved up quickly, rising to executive producer, before joining Nixon's presidential campaign. Tasked with improving the former vice president's TV image, Ailes advised Nixon to use more memorable phrases in debates and to maintain a fairly constant level of healthy tan. following Nixon's 1968 victory. Ailes set up shop in New York, said the New York Times. He flirted with the theater world, producing a few off-Broadway shows, and helped develop a short-lived news network called TVN. But Ailes' primary focus was politics. In the 1984 election, Ailes persuaded 73-year-old President Reagan to defuse concerns about his age by joking during a debate that he wouldn't exploit his opponent Walter Mondale's youth and inexperience. Working for George H.W. Bush 4 years later, Ailes oversaw a controversial commercial accusing Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis of giving weekend furloughs to first-degree murderers. Ailes left politics in 1993 and took the helm at CNBC, said the Los Angeles Times. After tripling the Business Channel's ratings, he helped NBC launch America's Talking, an all-talk cable channel that later turned into MSNBC. Ailes left the network in 1996 to create Fox News, where he perfected the on-air formula he'd pioneered at MSNBC. His anchors and hosts were bombastic men and beautiful women. Token liberal guests were browbeaten, talked over, and dismissed. Conservatives loved it. Fox News surpassed CNN's viewing figures in 2002 and became a must for Republican politicians, said the Wall Street Journal. The station fueled some of the right's most active and influential elements, including the Tea Party and climate change skeptics. But Ailes insisted Fox wasn't biased. "We're not programming to conservatives," he said. "We're just not eliminating their point of view." For all his success, Ailes lived in a world of paranoia and fear, said the Times. His home in upstate New York had an underground bunker containing 6 months' supply of food. He reportedly kept a gun in his office desk. But nothing could protect him when former Fox News anchor Gretchen Carlson filed a lawsuit last year accusing Ailes of sabotaging her career after she refused to have sex with him, prompting 25 other women to come forward with sexual harassment allegations. Ailes, who left the company with a $40 million payoff, denied the accusations. "I don't care about my legacy," he'd said in 2012. "It's too late. My enemies will create it, and they'll push it." On the Health and Science page, here's a short one called "Greetings from Garbage Island." Lying between New Zealand and Chile on the South Pacific, uninhabited Henderson Island boasts white sandy beaches, 57 species of flowering plant, and 38 million pieces of plastic garbage, the highest density of trash ever recorded. Researchers made the startling discovery during a routine survey of the 14.4 square mile coral atoll, which is so remote and inaccessible that in 1988 UNESCO declared it a World Heritage Site with a near pristine island ecosystem. Now Henderson is littered with 18 tons of fishing nets, toothbrushes, razors, lighters, water bottles, helmets, toy soldiers, and other refuse, the Washington Post reports. Markings suggest the debris came from China, Japan, South America, Europe, the U.S., Russia, and elsewhere around the world. Why did it end up on Henderson? The island sits on the western edge of the South Pacific Gyre, a circular ocean current that acts like a conveyor belt, dumping floating objects ashore. During a three-month stay on Henderson, the researchers found that about 3,500 pieces of plastic waste washed up onto the island's beaches daily. All told, some 9 million tons of plastic ends up in the oceans each year. It traps marine mammals and fish, gets swallowed by seabirds, never degrades, and can float around for decades. When we dispose of plastics, we think it goes away, says co-author Alex Bond. But there is no away. How exercise slows aging. If working out makes you feel younger, a new study suggests it's no illusion. Vigorous exercise can actually slow the aging process on a cellular level, turning back the clock nearly a decade. Researchers analyzed 6,000 adults based on their physical activity and biological markers of aging, Time.com reports. Most importantly, they used DNA samples to measure the length of the participants' telomeres, protein caps that protect chromosomes, like the plastic tips of shoelaces. Telomeres shrink with age. We lose bits of them every time a cell divides. In general, people with shorter telomeres die sooner and more likely to develop many of our chronic diseases, said study author Larry Tucker. Taking into account risk factors such as smoking, alcohol consumption, and obesity, the researchers found people who exercise strenuously, say running for 30 to 40 minutes 5 days a week, had longer telomeres. That gave them about a 9-year biological aging advantage over sedentary adults. Those who exercised more moderately had a 2-year edge. The researchers speculate physical activity could help preserve telomeres by reducing stress and inflammation. We all know people who seem younger than their actual age, Tucker says. Exercise can help with that, and now we know that part of that may be because of the effect on our telomeres. And we'll just flip right over to the Talking Points page. Here's one. Pence. Would he be an upgrade? President Mike Pence, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. The investigations and scandals surrounding President Trump have created a growing buzz in Washington about a potential Pence presidency, both from Republicans wistful for the days of a functional White House and from Democrats hoping for the lesser of two evils. Clearly, the vice president would be far more competent and would make the country safer. A former congressman and governor with 16 years in government, Pence is sane, thoughtful, and infinitely less likely to blunder into a nuclear war. Unlike the president, he also read the Constitution. Granted, he'd be the most conservative president of modern times, an evangelical Christian fiercely opposed to abortion, gay marriage, and the expansion of LGBT rights. But given the risks of an unstable authoritarian Trump, I'd opt for President Pence. The sooner the better. If Pence does become president, said Kyle Smith in NationalReview.com, the left will lead us in a national chorus of, whew, back to normal. But their welcome will be short-lived. As soon as Pence takes the oath, progressives will denounce him as a dangerous theocrat who hates women, minorities, and gays. His principled opposition to abortion will be framed as a supreme danger to women's health. He'll be labeled a freakish misogynist because he declines to have boozy one-on-one dinners with women other than his wife. But liberals can't have it both ways. If Trump represents a unique threat to democracy because he's not an ordinary Republican, Pence can't be intolerable because he is. Democrats should indeed welcome President Pence, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. Smooth as he is, he'll take over a broken Republican Party embroiled in a civil war between far-right ideologues, moderates, and a new faction, disaffected Trumpists, feeling they've been betrayed. With 30 million Twitter followers and TV networks clamoring for interviews, Trump himself would go nuclear, attempting to take the party down with him. Meanwhile, the Russia investigation would hardly disappear, said Matt Latimer in Politico.com. Would Pence pardon the disgraced president, as Gerald Ford did after Watergate? Indeed, was Pence himself present at meetings that might draw congressional or law enforcement scrutiny? When Ford took office after Nixon resigned, he declared, "Our long national nightmare is over." But it really wasn't, and it won't be if Trump is forced to leave office. And a short note or two. President Trump is keeping his promise to crack down on undocumented immigrants. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement made more than 41,000 arrests in President Trump's first 100 days, an increase of 37.6% over the same period in 2016. About 25% of those arrested had no prior criminal convictions. 17% of U.S. newlyweds in 2015 were of differing races or ethnicities, a five-fold increase over the 50 years since the landmark Loving v. Virginia Supreme Court case, according to the Pew Research Center. White Americans are the least likely to enter a mixed marriage, while Asian and Hispanic people are the most likely to do so. Black men are twice as likely to marry outside their race as black women. Facebook investigated nearly 54,000 potential cases of revenge, pornography, and sextortion on the social media network in 1 month. The company disabled more than 14,000 accounts over such content. 33 of the cases involved children. And we'll finish up with a quote from author Annie Dillard. "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org.